The fight is on. The fight is on. And we know how. Okay.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of this show or to explore our other shows, visit our website at ecojusticeradio.org and subscribe to our podcast. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, Oren Lyons, on Changing Our Values to Survive. Thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal350, and Wilder Utopia. If you like what you've heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You've been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350. Executive producer and host, myself, Jack Eit. Co-host, Jessica Aldridge. Co-host, Carrie Kim. And engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our fantastic programmers, including specials for Black History Month and International Women's Day. If you'd like to check out our specials, go to kboo.fm/ATNF4.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and this is Life Stamps, stories from here and there. I'm Joseph.
I am Tyson.
Join us every other Thursday at 10 a.m. as we discuss exciting destinations around the world. But not always from personal experience, but never without cultural awareness and a passion for travel.
Hey everyone, welcome to Life Stamps, stories from here and there. I'm Joseph.
I am Tyson.
And today we are going to be talking about, what are we talking about today, Tyson?
Today I want to talk to our listeners about the Yunnan province in southwest China.
Okay, so Yunnan province, so like you said, it's in southwest China. Does Yunnan province border any other countries?
It does. The southern border borders with Myanmar, Laos, and Vietnam.
And what is the province to the east of Yunnan?
And to that, oh God, I can't remember the name of that province. It's a Chinese province. And I want to say it's the Hunan province next to the Yunnan province. Am I right?
I don't know. I'm going to look it up real quick.
Okay. I think there's two provinces that border to the east.
Mm-hmm.
But you can assume, you can basically, thinking about how big China is, Yunnan is like southwest China,
mm-hmm. You
know, and it's a fairly big province because mm-hmm. if you look at the size of the province, it really is about the size of like Thailand
mm-hmm.
and then since with a little addition of like a little bit of Laos.
Guangxi
is the province directly east of there.
Directly east, and then we have Guangdong province, where that's where you can find like Shenzhen, and then Hong Kong is like right, you know, sandwiched in that, in Guangdong province.
Okay.
And so then, and the north of that is Hunan. So
So I was right. Just, it does border Hunan, but it's, but Hunan's to the north, not to the east.
It doesn't border Hunan.
Oh.
It's actually two provinces removed from Hunan. So I'm just trying to give our listeners more like a visual, like kind of like to map out in your mind, like Yunnan is pretty far west. And like what you said, it borders Myanmar, Laos, and Vietnam.
Yep.
So,
and it also borders Tibet.
And it also borders Tibet and looks like Sichuan province to the north.
Yeah.
And we're all familiar with Sichuan cuisine is very spicy, known for being very spicy.
Well, it's the pepper.
It's the pepper and the Sichuan peppercorns.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering then, why Yunnan? Why do you want to talk about Yunnan today?
Well, I think Yunnan's quite interesting because, like I mentioned, it is in southwestern China. Mm-hmm. So it kind of is a province with like kind of like three climates in a way.
Mm.
Because that southern border is actually in the Tropic of Cancer. Mm-hmm. So that means it begins the tropical zone mm-hmm. of that we're all familiar with sticky, swampy Southeast Asia.
Right.
So you can get a bit of that in the south of Yunnan. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to the northwest, it gets very Himalayan and Tibetan mm. and very mountainous.
Okay.
And then you go to the east, then it's kind of like more rivers and plains and like flat rice field kind of topography as well. So I thought it was an interesting province because of the cultural migration that you have at the southern borders, the cultural differences that you have in the Northwest Corridor, and because of just the eco-diversity that you have within the province as well. So I found it to be a pretty interesting place. And in the show notes this week, I'm getting a lot of my information from like a Grateful Dead blogger that I stumbled across.
Okay.
Couple. They're called Grateful G Nomads.
Uh-huh.
GratefulGNomads.com. I got a lot of information. If you happen to hear this ever in life, you know, mm-hmm. just, you know, I'm paying you a shout out and giving you credits for, you know, a very well-written blog that talked a lot about the backpacker's experience of traveling through the Yunnan province. So
okay.
Find them again, and it'll be in the show notes. GratefulGNomads.com. And mm-hmm. they've been like digital nomads since like 2006, you know, have a really good travel blog.
Okay. So they've just been like hanging out, traveling around the world since 2006.
Pretty much. And, you know, talking about different, you know, like a lot of these travel blogs, you know, a lot of different recommendations and tips and stuff, you mm-hmm. know. But I didn't want to leave that unsaid that I got a lot of my information from their blog.
Okay. So let's talk about just... where to start, like if we're going to Yunnan, where would you like to start us? Like, are we starting at the capital, or is there some other city?
Well, I want to talk a little bit about just some data points
mm-hmm.
about just so people have an idea of the perspective of the province itself.
Mm-hmm.
We know it's the southwestern province. I'd already talked about you know, just the different type of cultural migration that you'll have there with the Myanmar, Laos, Vietnamese, and Tibetan and stuff. The capital right. city is called Kunming.
Mm-hmm.
And to further your point, that is where we're going to start.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to get into a lot of details about that just yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked about the ecological diversity. What's also kind of interesting is on the western side, when it gets in the mountains, the rivers kind of flow from north to south.
Mm.
To kind of go along with the mountain valleys
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. But then once you get out of the mountain zone, most of the rivers just flow directly east.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So in the mountain zone, it's north to south, and then it's east.
Yeah.
That kind of tracks with like flowing out towards the sea, right? Because it's like the sea is more to the east also. Mm-hmm.
Correct. I think so. Yeah. Because as it goes through like the Himalayas and stuff like this, the rivers will flow mm-hmm. south, you know, then making their way, I think, to like Myanmar and stuff. And so the Mekong also is in the Yunnan province at some places.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's also the Yangtze, I think, is also in this province as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for people that know some of that geography, this province has the largest diversity of plant life because of all the different type of climate zones as well. You know, so I think a majority of the variation of the fauna and the plant life is does come from the mountainous region because of just different growing conditions for stuff like that. And then it's also very known as like a mineral province because of the mountains. So you got copper, nickel, aluminum, you know, different type of, you know, what's the word I'm trying to think of? Minerals and ores.
Mineral deposits, ore deposits.
Something like that, yeah. Commodities.
Natural resources.
Yeah. Natural resources, that's the better word that I was not pulling from my brain. So that's also pretty much like just some data points about the, you know, the province itself. And then I'll start us off in Kunming City.
Okay. All right. So let's go to Kunming.
Kunming, the capital of Yunnan Province, is known as the Spring City. I think the whole thought is it's similar to like Medellin, Colombia, in a way where it's eternally green. You know, it doesn't get too hot, but it doesn't get too cold. It doesn't really snow. There's just different things to explore as you start in Kunming. Fairly small city by Chinese standards, but big to, you know, like an American.
Right. Still like what, millions of people?
I think it's still like maybe 2.5 million people, 3 million people. But I think when people arrive there on a flight or something from Beijing or Shanghai, they're going to think it's quite small.
It's a small little village.
Yeah, they're not going to think it's too big. But it's I got recommendations from those bloggers I was talking about that you'd still want to spend about 3 nights in the city, you know, because it is quite big and, you know, there's still a few different districts and, you know, neighborhoods to explore and stuff. And some of the tips that I got about Kunming is to explore the Green Lake. To the west, there are hills. So there's hiking day, like for a whole half day hikes you can do on the western hills.
Is the lake actually green? Is that why it's called Green Lake? Or
I assume so. I assume the lake is green.
I see.
Yeah. But you never know because it's funny. I noticed with Chinese naming conventions, you know, translated to English for a lot of natural places, have these names sometimes that are taken through like local legend or local folklore and stuff, you know.
That makes sense, yeah.
So, but I think in this case, there's nothing, there's no story behind Green Lake. I think it just is a Green Lake.
I see.
But a local specialty they suggest here is Over the Bridge Rice Noodles is the name of the local Kunming dish.
Why Over the Bridge?
Well, it's similar to like pho noodles, Vietnamese, but it, like the chicken pho, which you know maybe as pho ga. These over the bridge rice noodles, I thought they actually made the noodles and maybe dried them over the bridge when I first read the title. But what's kind of interesting is the legend behind this is that they put a lot of chicken fat in the noodle soup.
Oh, okay.
And fat makes hot things stay hot longer because it's like an oil, you know, like oil in your frying pan. So,
yeah.
So if you have a lot of this like chicken fat in the chicken noodle soup, it would stay hotter. So the legend was that the noodles would stay warm as you walk over the bridge to the next neighborhood. So that's why they're called Over the Bridge rice noodles.
What an interesting little food hack. It's interesting these things that you learn like before you had something that could keep something hot, you know?
Right.
It's like, we'll just use more of this ingredient so it stays hot as we bring it over to.
Right.
I feel like that's so interesting.
Yeah, so you can think like, you know, like 600 years ago in Kunming City, you know, somebody like was visiting a friend, you know, and bringing soup over to them, or they were sick or whatever, you know, that the soup would stay hot and they could still walk over the bridge from the, I think, a river in the city and then, you know, bring them hot soup.
Totally. Yeah.
And let's see. So that's pretty much that. Another recommendation.
So are there lots of bridges then? Is that, is there like bridges? Like, is this from a specific neighborhood? Or?
It's got to be from a specific neighborhood or something, you know? And so I'm not entirely sure. But what I do know is that it's very popular. You can find it at stalls, you know, from like the food markets and stuff. They also do have like kind of similar to in the Taiwanese night markets. I think they do have like a night market or two that'll happen a few nights of the week here in Kunming City. They also recommend the bird and flower market, which I imagine you can probably buy birds and, you know, lots of different flowers from like local flower people as well. And then there's actually, you know, a bit of live music and good bars to, like, you know, check around within the Kunming neighborhoods and stuff. So, you know, I'm not sure what they've got in the realm of, like, traditional music because there are a lot of different demographics, not just the bordering Southeast Asian countries and the Tibetan people, but there's also different minority Chinese groups that are all littered throughout the province that have their own traditional dances and their traditional performances and stuff, you know.
Is it pretty easy to get around the city?
I get the impression it kind of is. I feel like it's a lot of it's pretty centralized, and then a lot of it turns into what a Chinese suburb would be, almost kind of like a farm town that had been swallowed up by a megalopolis kind of thing. Kind of like the way we know Forest Grove here.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I noticed that. Like, it seems like Chinese suburbs kind of are.
Like, they used to be little Chinese villages cities. And then it just sort of gets swallowed by the city.
Right, right. But they don't really, like, change, like, their road structure or anything for these places, you know. It's just once you get on the outskirts of the city, it's kind of like you're surrounded by villages.
I see.
I think.
So you mentioned like the over the bridge soup. Are there any other, you know, local dishes to sample?
Not that I'm aware of for Kunming specifically. And I'm sure they do have their things, but I think this part, because you're starting in the Kunming is a little more to the eastern border, where a lot of things are going to be similar to like other provinces to the east of there, which would be similar, like, kind of classic Chinese food of like thicker either rice or wheat noodle beef soups, I think. And then I think, you know, various rice dishes and different vegetables, bamboo, ginger. You know, I'm very much speculating. The one thing that I got that is specifically Kunming is the over the bridge.
Over the bridge soup.
Yeah, over the bridge rice noodle.
And
then a hostel recommendation that I was given for in Kunming, or three hostel recommendations that are should be all good value for the backpacker pocketbook, would be the Lost Garden Hostel in Kunming, Upland Hostel, or Hump Hostel.
Hump?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Cool.
Yeah, and that's Kunming. I think Kunming is going to be more like central China. So it is kind of your intro before you kind of get more adventurous into the province. It's kind of just your gateway to, you know, like city. It would obviously has the most buses. And I think there is, there may even be a bullet train there now. I'm not sure because China just keeps building more and more bullet trains, which is something I kind of want to talk about on another episode because the wave of new Chinese infrastructure with trains is quite incredible.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, so then we'd be moving on from Kunming. And then from the itinerary I have, it suggested is going to Lijiang, which is the ancient city. So this is where you're going to first kind of get this old Chinese feel kind of place to check out. It's like a very cobblestone preserved Chinese city with old temples to walk around, with nightly orchestra performed by the Noxi people. And the Noxi is a minority subgroup within China and within
what
the
region.
What
is that orchestra composed of? Like what kind of instruments?
I think it's a lot of like timpani kind of drums, you know, like big drums. It seems to be a lot of mallet. If you've ever seen like a dragon dance, performances and stuff.
So where very they rhythmic.
Seem, yeah, where you know, but it's not like rhythmic in the like African drums kind of way, or and it's not really rhythmic in like the marching band kind of way. They just kind of got their own kind of percussion rhythm that's done that's very Chinese with a lot of gongs and cymbal instruments type of thing, you know, so you just imagine those like and they seem to always like really enjoy playing with fire or some other type of thing, spinning fabrics and cloths and stuff when they do performances like with drums and stuff like this. Now the Noxie people themselves, I don't know, they've got their own tradition with their own you know, traditional dance and stuff, but there's nightly performances of that within Legion.
I see.
Other nature stuff that you can do or urban stuff within Legion, there's suggested to go to the Longolu Tower. Which I don't know how many meters up, but it's a very high tower.
Was it a man-made tower?
Yeah, I think I think it might even be modern architecture.
Oh, okay.
Not like an ancient temple or anything, but I think it's just kind of like a more modern building. But highest place you can get within the urban center to overlook and see the whole city, which if most of it is actually pretty traditional and ancient Chinese, then I imagine having that high view looking over the whole ancient city has got to be quite impressive.
Yeah. It should be.
Yeah. So, and then it's a kind of more of a bike recommended city. It's kind of flat around the outskirts and stuff. It doesn't have hills to hike like out on the outsides like Kunming does. It's more flat. So they you can rent bikes in a lot of places within Lijiang, and you can ride around you know, the outskirts, I think, in the countryside, and you've got like more lakes to explore and this kind of stuff, you know, within Lijiang. And then a place that's recommended is the Black Dragon Pool.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what's that about? Is that like a spring?
I think it's just kind of like a laguna type area and stuff with it. They probably have like, you know, some of those traditional Chinese kind of little bridges and stuff, you know, and maybe they've got little mounds within the pool so you can kind of go to like little mini islands within the laguna.
What do you do there? Do you go swimming?
I don't know if you can swim there. That's a good question. So that'd be interesting. And I actually, you know what? I forgot to mention about this region. There's the recommended times of year are kind of like autumn or spring, you know, because it can be very, very hot in some of these places, especially on the southern border, like with Southeast Asia in the summertime, you know, very hot and sticky. And even in the mountainous valleys where we're going to head when we start going further west, I'm mostly going to take us within Yunnan through the kind of northwest, making our way to the Tibetan border, because that's where it culturally really changes, and you get this intersect, which I find to be really interesting about this province, because it's kind of like the way we associate Texas with the Mexican border kind of thing, you know. So you get this cultural intersect of things that change or whatever, and I think that's what's cool about Kunming, because the food, or I mean, that's what's cool about Yunnan province, is because the food will change and the culture will change depending on what region. So if you go to the south, it's going to get very more Southeast Asian. And if you go northwest, it's going to get very more
more Tibetan kind of feeling.
Yeah, more mountainous and more Tibetan and stuff, you know. So very much like a nature province as well, because of the different things you can pick and choose. Not so much an urban exploring province.
right.
So, but yeah, so that's kind of Lijiang, you know. It's like your first taste of like an ancient city within the province and stuff, and then the Black Dragon Pool, and then the hostel that's recommended there is the October Inn.
Okay.
And I think that's probably owned and ran by some expats or something.
Go there in October?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, like I said, you kind of want to go in October, maybe in November, beginning a little cold, especially if you're going northwest. And summer is also like the rainy season. So, you know, that's also not recommended.
That's actually a good question. So would you recommend the best time to go there would be more in the like winter time?
I don't think so, unless you're a snow sports, snow trekking kind of person.
And, because it's so mountainous?
So I didn't get a lot of information of like what the average temperature or average rainfall would be in the wintertime. It would say specifically if you were going to do the southeast or the southern borders, you know. Because if that's your case, like you're already traveling through Southeast Asia and you want to pop into the Yunnan province, then maybe, yeah, winter could be quite good, you know, because I know a lot of people go to Thailand in the winter, for example, and stuff. And I don't think the climate will change too much. But I do think if you go too far north within the province, it's going to be noticeably much colder.
I see.
And especially in the northwest.
I see. So maybe in the fall or spring could be a good time to go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In a way, it kind of reminds me of like a Chinese version of like a mini California, how we associate all these different climates with California. You know what I mean? How you have the deserts and then you have like Big Bear and the mountains and then you have the coast and the ocean and stuff. So there's a lot of different things to kind of explore, a lot of cultural differences that show up within this province as well and stuff.
I see.
I thought it was quite interesting because I feel like Western media doesn't really portray China very well.
Right. Well, it's like it's just so massive. So the what we get is just like very tiny snapshots or,
right, you
know, or it might be like the culture that Chinese immigrants bring over, which is just also from a very specific part of China.
Right.
And Yunnan, I think, can be very surprising. Or like the mountainous parts of China, you don't really realize how much outdoor activities there are to do.
Right, right. And then, so speaking of outdoor activities, there's a big river gorge area as you start making your way up into the mountainous area called the Tiger Leaping Gorge.
Oh, okay.
And legend behind this is the most narrow part of the gorge. Very deep, right? If you think of like the Columbia River Gorge and how deep that really is or whatever.
Right.
And stuff. Very high up, but apparently the legend is that the most narrow part of the gorge, a tiger leaped over that, and obviously if it didn't make the leap, it would have fell so many thousand meters to its death down into the banks of the Yangtze.
So it made the leap though.
Yeah. And so this whole gorge area is recommended as like a 2-day hike. To get high above the Yangtze and get views of the Jade Dragon Snow Mountain. I think that's only named because maybe at a certain time of year it kind of looks like a snow dragon or something, the mountain itself.
I see.
And here there's no hostels that you would stay at, but you, if you're like, you know, because you're going to do a 2-day excursion, it's more of like a nature park kind of thing here going into the Tiger Leaping Gorge. There are many guest houses that you can stay at and stuff, you know, so you can kind of like do half the hike and then, you know, find the guest house, call it a night, and then do the second half of the park
find guest houses to stay at. Is camping recommended or is that not allowed?
I think you can. I think it's only, you know, advisable certain, you know, conditions. And this is another example why you wouldn't want to go in the summertime if it's like the rainy kind of monsoonish season,
right,
or whatever, you know. So much more preferably, you know, with like spring or autumn,
right,
as well. Okay. So
that makes sense.
So then like, so that would be your kind of like nature accommodation, hiking stuff, you know, somewhat in the province, you know. I mean, like I said, I'm kind of saying I'm taking you in on an itinerary where all roads lead to Tibet. That's kind of where we go from here.
So this is sort of like could be the start of a longer excursion where you start in Yunnan and then you make your way into Tibet.
Correct.
And keep going.
Correct.
And it just gets more and more remote.
More and more mountainous, more remote, and things like this. I mean, I'm sure there are some fairly populous Tibetan cities as well, but I'm not covering that province
or that. Well, and it also gets very spread out because, you know, most of the Chinese population lives in the east.
Right.
And so, like, I think Yunnan also is not as populated. I mean, it's still, for American standards, it's pretty populated, but I think it gets more remote.
Yeah.
And I think you're taking us more into this sort of, like, mountainous region, right? That's not as populated.
Exactly. Yeah, so you kind of start with through the modern city, then we go to like an ancient city, mm-hmm. you know. And like I said, I say the reason why I think Lijiang is still like an ancient city is just because, like you're saying, it's already so far west mm-hmm. in terms of the grand scheme of things, in terms of China right. itself. Mm-hmm. And then we're making ourselves through the gorge area. And then your next stop would be on this route would be Shangri-La.
Mm.
And this is kind of your gateway Tibetan city. And here the food is going to change because it's got a Tibetan aspect about it. So mm-hmm. there are yaks that are starting to make their way down to lower elevations around Shangri-La. So they have yak burger as a food option.
Yak burger?
Yeah.
Like...
Yeah, I wouldn't yak about it. I'm telling you the truth. It's a yak burger.
So it's a yak. Okay, I see. Interesting.
Yeah.
Do they eat it like a hamburger though? Is it like a, or mm. is it like ground yak meat that they you know like I think, make into a patty and that? But it's like more of a local dish.
It is more of a local dish, because this is kind of
I know, but it's like, do they have like? It's not like you know hamburger buns and then yak burger. And then, you know.
I mean, potentially. I only got yak burger. So my interpretation of how I visualized it, it was a circular ground yak meat.
I see.
And then, you know, potentially wrapped in lettuce if they didn't not
is
have
this,
bread.
Is this still information from the blog? This is like
all this is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, you know. And, you know, as you read blogs, you only get, like, real small little snippets of information, you mm-hmm. know. So all of it is quite interesting, mm-hmm. I might add. But a lot of it's mysterious. So, yeah. But what I did conclude from there is, like, once you get to Shangri-La and you're starting to get the Tibetan livestock and the Tibetan culture, and this is kind of like gateway Tibetan city, mm-hmm. this is where the food is changing mm-hmm. and it's not being traditionally Chinese, you know, as we know Chinese cuisine to be. This right. is where we're starting to get bigger livestock animals, and dairy is starting to show up in the local food and the local cuisine, as well as the culture of people are starting to change as well mm-hmm. and everything is changes a little bit. So that's kind of why Shangri-La is like the gateway.
I see.
You
I
know see. Mm-hmm. Or the base camp of for exploring Tibet on the Chinese side.
Right.
In to some extent. So, mm-hmm. but it was recommended to try yak burgers.
Do you know,
when
like,
you're in Shangri-La.
Shangri-La, like, is this is the, because there's like the saying of Shangri-La is like sort of your perfect place or like, you know, paradise or something. Have you heard that before?
I kind of have, but I don't know if it's the same, the same way one would define nirvana. In you know, Hindu faith, for example. I don't know.
I don't think it's that specifically. I think it's sort of like the like ideal place. Like your Shangri-La is sort of like your ideal.
So it's just your utopia.
Kind of like utopia, I guess. Yeah.
Okay.
Do you know like the background story
of why the Chinese named Shangri-La Shangri-La?
No, like why? Like why is why is that a term that we use? Like.
That I don't know. Mm. Yeah, no. I mean, that's, you know, just something we've always picked up. We've borrowed so much stuff from other languages, you know, English.
Right.
That I assume that maybe somebody once mentioned it and they're like, oh, we like that. Why don't we put that in Webster's right now? Mm. I mean, I have no idea.
Or
Oxfordian. I don't know.
It's so interesting because, yeah, when you said the city, Shangri-La, I was like, oh, is that having to do with the actual, like, yeah, utopian idea, but I guess not. And I just looked up Shangri-La because I'm so curious. Yep. And this is probably interesting. It's actually a fictional place in Tibet's Kunlun Mountains. So it's this fictional Shangri-La is in Tibet.
I see.
Described in the 1933 novel Lost Horizon by English author James Hilton, and he portrays Shangri-La as a mystical, harmonious valley gently guided from a lamasery enclosed in the western end of the Kunlun Mountains. Shangri-La has become synonymous with any earthly paradise, particularly a mythical Himalayan utopia. an enduringly happy land isolated from the world. So this is so...
It becomes even more and more mysterious.
Yeah. So when you're saying Shangri-La, I'm like, is that the Shangri-La? No, apparently it's not. Apparently that's just a city in Yunnan.
Right.
And it has nothing to do with this fictional place that James Hilton is talking about. But it's interesting because that's permeated Western culture as like the ideal place.
Right. But you know, now that you had mentioned that, it wouldn't surprise me if somebody actually made a town in Washington and called it Sasquatch.
Uh-huh.
Per example, because we already know there's a legend tied to this. And so like, you know, and if we want people to explore and go looking for Sasquatch, why not just make a town called Sasquatch?
But so I'm sure the city's been called Shangri-La for a long time. I don't think
the city is older than the legend.
But the legend is 1933
from an English interpreter.
No. That's when it was like this fictional idea. Shangri-La was created by James Hilton.
I thought it was a proverb of what you were saying, like, you know, one's utopia, perfect mountain place or whatever, and it goes from, it's like a really, really old, you know, like proverb or folklore, and then maybe everybody knew it, and then they're like, oh, well, we're close to Tibet, why don't
oh my goodness, you're actually spot on.
I just looked up
Shangri-La City, uh-huh, and it says, okay, this is what it says about the name. The city was originally a county name called Zhongdian. The Tibetan population referred to the area by its traditional name, Gyalthang. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Meaning Royal Plains. On 17th of December 2001, the Chinese government renamed the county Shangri-La after the fictional land of Shangri-La in the 1933 James Hilton novel Lost Horizon.
Now you see because I wouldn't even thought about that if you didn't just like start researching on the fly right now.
And it's what you're saying. It's exactly what you're saying. Part of an effort by the Chinese government to promote tourism in the area.
Exactly.
So they changed I love this. This is so interesting because it's basically like you have an author in the West who made this fictional place called Shangri-La. And so then the Chinese government's like, we're going to name this city Shangri-La and it'll be like the paradise that people are searching for.
Correct.
And so because people might be searching for like, how do I get to Shangri-La, you know, thinking that it's a real place.
Right.
And they just go to this place and they're like, oh, I went to Shangri-La.
I mean, pop culture travel is just such a phenomenon in this day and age. You know, for example, take Dubrovnik in Croatia. You know, a lot of people would go there. It's a cool ancient city, you know, in the Adriatic in Southeast Europe. But it wasn't until Game of Thrones that it just exploded.
Right.
You know? And I mean, locals aren't going to complain until they can't go to sleep at night because the tourists are so loud and so ruckusy. But you know, I mean, before they're always kind of like, oh, we got some tourist dollars, blah, blah, blah. Now it's like, they're not used to it because their revenue like tripled.
Right, yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's if it can boost tourism, I just think it's so interesting because, you know, when you were telling me like, oh, Shangri-La City, I was like, you know, thinking about like the mythical Shangri-La,
right?
And this whole runaround, you know.
Well, I was curious about that too because there was actually a female group from the 50s during like the bebop era called the Shangri-Las, you know. And the only reason why I knew about that is just because it was one of those things I used to have to hear as a kid from my parents, you know, one of those 50s, you know, boy or girl act kind of like Temptations or anything of this nature. But there's one from I think New Jersey called the Shangri-Las.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, I know that name.
Right. You're like, where have I ever heard that name before? Yeah.
And it's like, so it should mean something. Uh-huh. And it's funny because I thought it had like some kind of like actual like Middle Eastern origin of a mythical story or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Kind of like a genie in the lamp kind of thing.
Just kind of like it's in like the cultural consciousness where it's like, we've heard this thing before, but it's like, because it's not something that, you know, you're like supposed, you know, you're not like forced to read it as a kid or something. It's just sort of like out there in the cultural, you know, mush of things that we hear when we're growing up and stuff. So
yeah.
Yeah.
But anyways, moving on. Other than eating yak burgers, I think you're going to find some dairy products and stuff once you get to Shangri-La, because you are kind of at, you know, the gate to Tibet.
Interesting.
And stuff here. You've got a national park called the Puda Kuo, which is actually Chinese very first national park out of the whole country. It's the first very first one that was defined as like China's national park, the Puda Kuo Park. I don't know how much time one spends in Puda Kuo, right outside of Shangri-La, but you know, obviously there's recommended great hiking and stuff. And then there's also, like, similar to Lijiang, there's a big lake outside of the town, so you can kind of go there. And then maybe there's some like traditional lake houses you could stay at and stuff too, if you don't want to stay like central in Shangri-La City.
I see.
And if you do want to stay central in Shangri-La City because of the bus and you're moving on or whatever, you know, the recommendation here is Tavern 47 is the name of the one good hostel here in Shangri-La.
Okay.
So
Tavern 47.
Yeah. Cool. And then this is the one that I found to be the most interesting. Here's a city called Shaxi, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, or Shaxi. And this is like the ancient tea trading town. And so, and they still do markets and stuff at this town. You know, it still was all, like a bustling area where Chinese would bring their tea to Shaxi. And Tibetans would ride down from the north and bring all like yaks and horses and stuff. And then they would sell their horses and their yaks to the Chinese to get tea from them. And then the Chinese would take the horses and the yaks and ride them all the way into India to spread and sell their tea within India. You know, so this is very much like a tea horse yak trading town outpost called Shaxi. And they have their markets every Friday, and it's not just like tea and horses, but it's like all kinds of local farmers from the area and communities and stuff come here on every Fridays and bring their different goods. And so you can imagine like a lot of mountain farmers and stuff will come down and come here to Shaxi, you know, because it's like the low valley place historically where Chinese and Tibetans would intermingle and do business.
That's interesting for sure.
And stuff. And then there's a river that flows through the city for kayaking. You can even forage from like little boats off of this river, you know, low hanging fruit, if you would, with the sticks and rice and other things you can get through kayaking from like the river boat. There's a really interesting hiking trail here through Shaxi called the Shibao Shan. And within here they have like a lot of like hilltop temple, you know, Chinese monastery kind of places and stuff that you'll see along the hike. So it's a lot of architecture to take in as well, ancient architecture to take in for hiking and stuff. I imagine this is kind of more rocky in the mountainous sense, you know, because it's very, you know, kind of like at the base of the Tibetan geology as well, you know, for like the mountains that are surrounded the place and stuff. And if you want to be touristy, they do ancient tuk-tuks that are like horse-drawn carriage and stuff like this.
I know.
So it looks like a tuk-tuk, but with a horse.
I see.
Instead of like, you know, the motorbike in the front for the driver.
I think it's time to start our trivia section.
Let me give you one hostel recommendation for Shaxi also.
Okay.
It's an old Bai style courtyard, you know, a place where people would tie up their horses and do business, and that's called the Pen 46.
Pen 46?
Yeah, like like horse pen.
Okay.
Pen 46 youth hostel.
A pen like P-I-N?
P-E-N.
Oh, P-E-N, pen. Okay.
Yeah, like a horse pen. 46 is the number of youth hostel here in Shaxi.
Okay.
You know, for exploring that place.
Cool. Yeah, and check it out.
Yeah, no. It's Harvey, take us away today for trivia and comments.
Let's go.
Okay, now let's move on to trivia and comments. Trivia time. Trivia time, hip hip hooray. Listener comments as well, handled the life stamps way. Today and every day.
right. Thank you for that, Harvey. And if you're just tuning in now, you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. And this is Life Stamp Stories from Here and There. And I'm Joseph. I'm here with my co-host, Tyson. And we've been talking about Yunnan Province in China. And now we are going to move over to some trivia. And if we have time, I know that we're running out of time here, but if there's time, we'll also get to a few listener comments. So, all right, let's move into the trivia question portion.
Yeah, I got some questions for you, you know, about this Yunnan province. Mm-hmm. What cultural activities can people participate within Yunnan?
Cultural activities, well... I know that there's some local cuisine to eat, like the crossing the bridge noodles.
That's correct.
There's also tea. I'm guessing like tea ceremonies, maybe, or sampling tea, tea tasting.
Yeah, that's a good example. There's what's really kind of interesting.
Maybe music
Yunnan
also
in the south, because I didn't really take us. I kind of took us on the Tibetan tour.
Uh-huh.
But in the south, there's a famous tea terrace,
mm-hmm,
that's actually I want to say 1400 years old. Started
wow.
by here I got the information here. Roughly 700. Roughly in the year 700.
Mm-hmm.
Is when they first started building the rice terraces,
mm-hmm,
by the Hani people.
The Hani?
Yeah. And this famous rice terraces, if you want to see pictures of them, are called the Yuan rice terraces.
Mm.
And they're really quite impressive, you know, if you've ever seen pictures of them and stuff, you know, just very extensive. Looks like kind of like a kaleidoscope from the sky and everything.
That's cool.
You know, and it's pretty fascinating feat of, like, you know, ancient farming with the, you know, the, what do you call the reservoirs of water between, like, the rice fields? But, you know, like, I would call them, like, canal irrigation or something.
Yeah.
And it's pretty fascinating. So, yeah, that's definitely something you do, because the Hani people still live and have been doing this for over 1400 years.
Wow, interesting. All right.
Or not 1400 years? Like 14,000.
1400.
1400.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1400. Yeah. Anyways,
14,000 would be
14
way
centuries
back. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not 14 millennium.
Let's Let's move on to the next question.
I'm talking about ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm.
What are the names of some of the ethnic groups that are in the Yunnan province?
I'm going to guess Han.
That's close. There's
Han Chinese.
There's a Hani.
Are you sure? Because Han, I think Han Chinese, like, you mean like indigenous ethnic groups?
Yeah, minority groups.
Okay.
Because I mentioned those rice terraces aren't, uh-huh, they're a minority group of the Hani people.
Okay. Bai?
That's correct. Then that was like a somewhat Tibetan minority group.
Tibetan?
Yeah.
Hui? Is that one?
But there are 25 total different minority groups within the province.
Is Yi one?
Yi is one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Zhuang?
I don't know. I wrote down some of the most common ones that I have.
I'm cheating. I'm sorry.
Yeah, he is. He's got his laptop open and he's just like Googling and everything. I can't even play trivia with Joseph fairly much.
It was already pulled up.
But I thought you would have remembered when I was talking about the Noxi people and, you know, Li Jiang, because they do...
You're talking about a lot of stuff.
They do their nightly, you know, performance dance with the timpani drums and the fabric and stuff.
To be fair, I don't have, like, minority or, like, ethnic groups pulled up. Or, I mean, I don't have, like, indigenous groups pulled up. I just have the ethnic groups.
Yeah.
Which is why I said Han, because Han Chinese is, like, the majority, I guess.
Here's something I think you'll find interesting, though.
Uh-huh.
Remember way back when we were talking about Luoyangyuan and the... You know, the Stone Mountains?
Mm-hmm.
There's a famous stone forest within Yunnan.
Oh.
And I think
that's fun.
They just call it Stone Forest.
Mm-hmm.
No special name, so it's quite easy to Google and research.
Mm-hmm.
How old is this stone forest in Yunnan?
5,362 years old.
You said 5,000?
362 years.
Sure, sure. Anyways, you're way off.
8 months.
You're way off.
23 days.
You got to think about...
2 hours.
Don't you ever study caves and, like, erosion and, you know, geological things?
Not in a long time.
Okay.
It's not one of my pastimes.
Well, you got to think. Rocks form over a very, very, very long period of time.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
So...
Okay, let's say 5 million years.
Nah, too long.
1,230,500.
Nope. Too many guesses. Anyways, but...
How old are these rocks?
500,000 years old. 500,000.
I was close. Come on. I said 1,000,000.
But they're quite interesting. It's a stone forest, and it's also sort of like vertical rocks similar to Lu-Yon. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing with these rocks is they believe they were originally came from the ocean, and they were washed ashore every so many thousands of years, and then the waves just kind of keep pushing them inward and stuff. And they're actually quite close to Kunming City.
That's
another day trip you can do from there.
That's super interesting. Yeah, they look very beautiful.
Yeah. You know what? I don't have any more trivia questions for you, actually.
Yeah.
That was kind of wrapping it up.
Time for a potato.
I've got a simple one, but I think you already know the answer to it.
Well, do we want to talk about comments, listener comments?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
Do you got any listener comments queued up for us this week?
Yeah. So I have one. This is from Lucy.
Okay.
Out of... Boston, Lucy from Boston.
Yeah, she didn't come from your hometown.
No.
Okay.
She is asking, what's your preferred style of travel? Budget, luxury, adventure, or relaxation?
I think budget 100% for me.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I don't like to get like tied into a long adventure. I like to like dictate the terms and cut my adventure off when I want to. I don't want to like get stuck, you know, like in a camel caravan in the middle of the Sahara and be like, oh man, it may be 5 days till I get back to a bigger city.
Totally.
I like to end it more on my terms.
I guess it depends on like what adventure means also.
Well, I like day trip adventures, but I like to come back to the city at nighttime kind of thing. That's the kind of traveler I am. But I'm very budget because I'm very into the shoestring thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm into the, like doing the street food and, you know, hostels. Like, you know, I'm definitely like kind of outgrowing hostels, but I love the community that comes with hostels and still making meals together and using the kitchen and meeting fellow travelers or to have people to travel with and explore and do things with.
Yeah.
However, I'm definitely, you know, I'll take a private room over a bunk bed any day.
Totally. Yeah, I know. I feel you. I also like the community aspect of hostels for sure. And I think I like budget in the sense, I mean, I have preferred budget travel, when I was younger. And I feel like for me now, it really depends on the type of trip I'm planning because I like budget or adventure. I think it's also like how I think about adventure. I think adventure can sometimes to me mean like there's no set itinerary. It's sort of just like choose my own path
for
you know, a specific amount of time. I'm not like, oh, I'm going to go here and I have everything planned out. It's like, oh, I'm just going to go to this area and just kind of like explore.
Well, I do that too. I'm not really a planner. I'm more of like a cheap ticket when I know I've got time off, and the cheap ticket that seems the most interesting to me,
right.
I just kind of go with it, and then I usually don't put a lot of plans together other than what finding the hostel is actually quite important to me because I want to make sure they have everything I want to have. Excuse me, I almost tapped the mic, but a good several 5 days in a city, you know, so I can do my laundry and I can cook meals. And
I think also another type of traveling that I prefer if I were to do it would be like if I had the ability to do it would be more like long-term stays in places, like staying in one place for a month or something and then going to another place, like not really like being able to immerse myself more in like the town that I'm staying in, the culture and everything.
Get used to it and start developing your favorite spots and everything.
I think what I haven't done a lot of, and then when I think about like relaxation travel, I'm like, well, I like that, but it's not in the sense of like, I wouldn't plan an international trip for relaxation in that sense. Like maybe if there was a relaxation element to it, like maybe if there's like, you know, maybe 3 days, it's going to be like a little hotel by the beach or something. And that's going to be relaxing, but I'm not going to plan an entire trip that's just about relaxation. And then with luxury travel, I kind of stray away from that for the most part, because I feel like that's very detached from the culture, where it's like, you know, everything is like, especially like I always feel a little weird doing like something that is like maybe affordable for me, but is so like expensive. Like,
do you consider modern architecture luxury travel? Like, what I mean is like, if like somebody specifically is just going to go to Dubai, for example, you know, in my perception of things, I'd see a destination like that, like almost everything is kind of like luxury kinda travel. Luxury. But you're kind of doing it because, you know, you're trying to see modern architecture and new buildings and, I don't know,
I
new things
call that
of that
luxury
nature.
Travel, because I'm sure it's even possible to be cheap, you know, to have budget options in Dubai.
Right.
I feel like there are definitely destinations where you need more money.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily like you're doing luxury things. It's just like maybe just the, you know, the point is that maybe you just need money to travel to a certain place or something.
Right.
We have time for one more question, so let's move on.
Okay. Well, let's see. Which one am I reading? I've got four questions here. One from an Australian, one from somebody from Spain, one from somebody from Ohio, one from somebody from Boston.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Boston, really?
Yeah, another person from Boston. Wow. Yeah.
Popular today.
Yeah. So I could read. I don't know. No, let's switch it up. Sofia Maria Francisco from Madrid asks, hey, Tyson and Joseph, I'm a total foodie. More of a street food foodie than a fine dining foodie.
Mm-hmm.
Give me your top five countries for street food, regardless of price. And I can totally see that because she comes from tapas culture in Madrid. So, you know, it's just always, I bet you it's just.
I'm going to give cities because countries is a little difficult because not every country has like the same street food in every city.
Well, yeah, that's fair too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think that's kind of what she was. But you're obviously, when you're buying the ticket, you're buying the ticket to that country.
I feel like I really like the street food in Bangkok.
Okay.
And also Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia.
Yeah.
They had a really like big street food market. I really wish I got to Taipei because I've heard the street food scene there is pretty phenomenal also, but I didn't have the chance to go there.
Right.
And
are you talking about night markets or you're just talking about any time of day?
A night market kind of situation.
Well, when you're talking about Bangkok and Kuala Lumpur.
I feel like, some of these markets are definitely more of a night market thing. Yeah.
Okay.
And Thailand in general has a lot of these night markets, which are really cool.
Yeah.
To get street food. I think, let's see. Yeah, as far as Asia goes, I feel like Seoul also had a good street food scene.
Okay.
I haven't really like experienced like big street food scenes in Europe.
I have.
So yeah, maybe you have some European recommendations.
Yeah, well, I mean, Sofia, I already know being, you know, from Madrid, you know, there's crazy tapas culture and stuff, you know, and you just go different places and they got the plates and you can see what they offer or read the menu, and it's all quite cheap and you can just move around. Obviously, also in Barcelona, you have La Ramblas, which is, you know, a big, huge market, you know, for like lots of, you know, Spanish charcuterie, Spanish cheese, Spanish jamon, things like this. But I think one that I really enjoyed in the central square of Krakow, in Poland, they've got like all the Polish food, and it's really quite impressive. They have vendors come out there every day with like the pierogies, the Polish kielbasa. There's a Polish kind of like sour cabbage soup called bigosz, and then they have like different like bread roll things that you can fill with like the bigosz and stuff. What else was the plotski, which are like their potato pancakes and stuff. So it all feels very like charming Polish old world to go to like the main square in Krakow.
That sounds delicious.
And they just have like, you know, all that food there and stuff. And it's, I really like that. And then I'll always tell people you can't go wrong with Mexico.
I mean, Mexico. Yeah.
The puestos and the places just, you know, just grilling tacos.
I think in terms of like,
is like
wherever I go in Mexico, like I, like wherever I go in the country, I can find a good street food scene. I think Mexico is a good,
good
country for that.
Yeah. Mexico is like, you know, you can't be disappointed because you always got fresh juices and stuff. The agua frescas.
Yeah.
And tamales and tacos.
Really good street food scene. I think one of my favorite street food scenes, though, and just because it holds also a special place in my heart, is Portland.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think Portland has, it's up there with all the international greats in terms of, you know, street food. And I think what's unique about Portland is the variety, because, you know, it's like, it's very American in the sense of it's like the melting pot. Lots of different cultural. It is not, though.
We want to say it's very American because there is so much fusion here in Portland.
Yeah.
But we also have a lot of immigration. So it's very.
That's kind of what I mean. It's like a. It's
encapsulates
like very international.
Flavors.
Like
right.
Not just like, you know, because it's like when we talk about a country's street food, it's very much like those country's specialities.
Right. Right.
And I think it's what's interesting in Portland is the like variety is quite big.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm getting hungry now. We'll have to cut this episode short. So
we're going to go to some food carts.
get some food and stuff, you know. I mean, I love Nong's, right, by the way, from the radio station here. It's always delicious.
Oh, yes. All right. Well, we are out of time. So it was a pleasure, Tyson, to do this episode with you.
Pleasure to you as well, Joseph.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening. This has been Life Stamp Stories from Here and There on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. And until next time, happy travels.
Happy eating as well.
You have been listening to Life Stamps Stories from Here and There on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. Join us in 2 weeks for our next